This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rusland, today we have some of BFM's finest, quite frankly. From Skip Intro, Julian Yap.
Hello.
And we have the return of, after I don't know how long.
Ages.
you also presumably would know her voice here from BFM, from Evening Edition. She is Lee Tree Lin.
Hello.
It's been like 2 years since you've been on.
A thousand, Cam, it feels like.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. I can imagine. That's what listeners say after each show. God, that was a thousand years. It's only half an hour. I felt like a thousand. So our three topics this week are, topic number one is the swastika and the power of symbols. Topic number two is Bon Appetit. And finally, topic number three will be generational catch-up. So, the swastika, topic number one.
Who chose that?
Yeah.
I wonder who.
In this room, who?
Anyway, so I was recently at the Georgetown Literary Festival because I'm a man of the people. And one of the, I was moderating some sessions, and one of the writers was a German guy, a young German guy, by the name of Lukas Rietschel. And he has just written a book by the name of Im der Faust in die Welt schlagen.
Ha. It sounds like a book.
I understood all of that.
Yeah, it's something about smashing the world with a fist. And he writes about Eastern Germany, the old East Germany, where he is living. And he writes about two brothers, one of whom gets drawn into neo-Nazi far-right world. And he told a story which is really haunted me, and kind of really the topic in a way is about historical vacuums, growing up in historical vacuums, because he was saying how the East Germany was taken over by the communists, by the Soviet Union at the end of the war. And so they then told a story in East German of how the Nazis were all in West Germany, not them. They were not Nazis. They couldn't be because they were communists. The Nazis were over there. So when the Berlin Wall fell down, there was no kind of like gelling together of their history tellings. So people in Eastern Germany now live in a kind of historical vacuum. So he told a story of that's in his novel, which has not been translated into English yet. And he, school children, I guess this happened to him. School children walking one day saw a swastika daubed on a rock outside the school. And the child said to the teacher, "What's that?" And the teacher said immediately, "Go away, don't look at it, don't look at it, go back into the school." And said to all the other kids, "Don't look at it, go away." So the kids, these young kids, had no understanding of what this symbol was, but they did get a sense that it was powerful. The headmaster then went over, and they said they watched him out the window, and he was walking backwards to this rock, and he surreptitiously dropped a blanket over it to cover the symbol, and they were just so intrigued. What is this thing? In German, they call it something like the Crooked Cross. They don't call it swastika. And recently, we had this university convocation ceremony where some guy turns up and gives the Nazi salute. And saying that there's some connection between that symbol and solidarity with the Palestinian people. I'm not sure if the Palestinian people would be very happy to hear that. Mm. But what I'm asking about is, if you live in a historical vacuums, symbols that you don't understand can have great power. And I'm wondering if you too have experienced this or seen that. I mean,
I have a sort of sideways tangent to that, which is that I would argue that in some ways a lot of us live in historical vacuums of ignorance. I mean, obviously I recognize that with your story, it's actually like a true separation, right? I mean, there really is no other way of understanding the world in which they live because knowledge has been withheld. But I think for a lot of us, I mean, sometimes when I watch people casually drop sort of Nazi-related actions or words, or for that matter, when there is this idea of like, oh, but the SS, they looked cool. And I've heard that more than once, right? This argument that, no, I don't believe in, you know, anything that the Nazi party actually stood for. I don't believe in any of that. But I mean, they looked great. I love all the symbols surrounding it. So when you first said symbols, that was my thought. I know people who just love the symbology around the party, and with good reason. I mean, they chose that because they were powerful, because they could market it. And so for me, what I'm seeing is, I think, a sense of marketing that has far outlasted what it was meant to do. You know, now we're reaching a point where it's also been repackaged. I mean, every single time, Star Wars, for instance, we were talking about this with the stormtroopers, you know, it reinforces in a backwards way where the reference came from. Ergo, you know, this sort of like sort of SS, Nazi,
yeah,
uniform, guns. So I think that there are issues with that. I think that there are, like I said, it's a sideways thing, but yeah, I do feel people don't look it up enough.
I think right now there's also the problem, I don't know if it's a problem, but in a lot of ways when we discuss certain topics, it can go into, well, you know, this is, you can compare this, as, it's just as bad as the Nazis. And then if anyone just tried to debate that or try to, you know, have a conversation about it or discussion, there's that implication that you're defending Nazism. And there's, I think that, of course, that stops discussion at all, but it also prevents anyone from learning anything further about it. You know, when you're in a vacuum, you can't see the
you don't know. You're,
yeah, the sides of the vacuum. You don't know where which part you're at. For me, I've only ever absorbed this in terms of pop culture, hardly, not very much in school. I think we have moved away from the time when we saw a lot of parodies of it. The first time I ever heard of Nazism was when I was a kid and I watched Fawlty Towers. And yeah, John
don't,
Cleese
don't mention the wall.
Did the thing, yeah. But we don't have that in popular culture anymore.
But in popular culture, I mean, you know, Nazis are always bad. So how did someone make the equation that Nazism good? So, for instance, actually, there is a, in Indonesia, there is a strong pull towards the imagery, as you were saying, Lynn, of Nazism, without necessarily having any understanding. But I don't, that's the thing, is that it doesn't matter if you have an understanding, and you cannot counter it with, oh, but here are the facts of it. It's not about that. It's about the pull of the imagery, divorced of historical accuracy.
Yeah, and the problem with that is also, to your story earlier, the headmaster and the backwards walking and the blanket, all of that just increases the intrigue around the symbol, right? I mean, if you looked at a swastika devoid of context, I don't know that it would have been something so either as horrifying or as polarizing as most of us find it. You know, we see it, we know instantly what it signifies, we know to look away. But if you kind of tell children, you need to look away now, I mean, what is that? That is in and of itself increasing the power of the symbol, right? Vacuum or no vacuum.
Well, just to finish off then with the story that this German writer wrote, about the far right. I asked him then, because it's getting very popular in the eastern part of Germany and Saxony, and I asked him, you know, are these people Nazis then? Do they have pictures of Hitler on their bedroom walls and stuff? And he said, no, they don't. And they don't, then you can't really call them Nazis per se, because they can't join those historical dots. It's just about a sense of a smallness, perhaps, that they are kind of shown in the way that they live their lives compared to others. But they know that there's a bigness that they have some right to.
Is it a rallying cry? Is the symbol a rallying thing that people identify with?
Yeah, because the symbol is just a mushy, garbled bunch of images to do with maleness and violence and winning.
Mm. The rightness of your way of life, I guess.
Yeah. Mm. And that's the thing to, I think, to concentrate on. And it takes a lot of work and a lot of money to counteract that. But so that was my weekend in Penang. That's what I did on my holidays. So we move on from one extreme to the other.
It truly is,
it
yeah.
It truly is. Only on A Bit of Culture. Topic number two, Bon Appetit, Lynn.
Yes, so Bon Appetit, specifically Bon Appetit's YouTube channel. So, of course, Bon Appetit began life as a magazine. It has since also become a website with kind of recipes, articles, just all the usual trappings you expect to see on an internet platform. But where it really shines is the YouTube channel. I am not somebody who engages with YouTube as a producer of content. I'm not that kind of internet goer, I suppose. You know, I don't tend to veer towards YouTube channels for that. But I am hooked, I tell you, on Bon Appetit. And that is because it's not, I think, what you would expect from a cooking magazine. It's not what you would expect them to put out. You would expect cooking demos. You would expect recipe, you know, demos, things like that. And instead, what it's become is this weird workplace sitcom that also has cooking challenges, that also has travel episodes. You've got these very big characters. And the best part of it is that they're real people, you know, and you see real frustrations, you see actual irritations between people, you see actual bonds.
It's like you're describing Friends.
It's 2019.
Exactly. It's 2019 Friends. And the internet has embraced it with this wholesome intensity that I'm really enjoying as well. Because I think we're starved for wholesome content, quite frankly. You know, there just isn't something else exactly like this where it's not problematic. It's just really great. And there's something so satisfying about watching Claire Saffitz attempt to perfect something that she got right on the first try. She didn't have to keep going. You know, she makes gourmet versions of snack foods and she does not have to keep going, but she does. And I identify with that and I love her. And I'm not alone. I think it's a meme now, right? I would die for Claire from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen. Yeah. It's a thing. It's an acronym that you can churn out on the internet and people know where you came from. So it's kind of a legit internet sensation that has almost no badness associated with it. And it's so rare on the internet.
Sure, until we describe that they actually like dogfighting at night. But
they go hunting. So that's, yeah.
But then they do actually stress on finding your own meats. None of this goes to waste. We're doing it and we respect the bird and the animal. Yeah. And pushing for sustainability in farming.
You're a fan.
I love Bon Appetit. I think
we have had many conversations.
I think it's. I watch an episode every night before I sleep and when I wake up. It's and they're great rewatch videos as well, because there's a satisfaction, of course, of people doing things and getting a project completed. There's you know, a series where they make with It's Alive with Brad, but It's Alive going places. So Brad Leone, who is just the most normal, but the coolest guy you can ever want in
the goofiest, the most sort of out there,
the guy's guy, yeah, like everyone's friend. And he goes out and he makes a knife or he makes a grill, and it's satisfying to have a product at the end of it. And I've always loved cooking shows and cooking videos, but this is like what a cooking show today is.
Have either of you actually cooked any of the things that? Because I mean, you're talking about Lynn, the challenges where he has to make a snack
makes,
or something.
She makes Mentos and Kit Kats.
But they actually make actual edible dishes as well.
Sure, but that's not the appeal. I mean,
no. Okay.
I've cooked their food before from the website. I've cooked certain things on the food demos. The recipes are great. So I guess that helps in terms of the credibility that these are actual people who are good at their jobs, which is the other part of the pleasure of this, I think. You're watching people have fun. You're watching people be good at their jobs and you're watching people do it in a wholesome workspace, which I think in a world where, sorry, I did the inner world, but in a world where people are stressed and burnt out and tired and maybe not working with people they enjoy. And, you know, I think there is a pleasure inherent in coming back and sitting down and watching this beautifully laid out test kitchen.
Yeah, it
and
is.
Everybody
it
getting
is.
Along.
Because it's not, these are not amateurs. These no. are absolute professionals in a swish place. And I mean, I watched it for the first time just now, and I enjoyed it. It was very nice.
What did you watch?
I watched I can't remember her name, make Mentos. Mentos?
Claire makes Mentos.
Right. Yeah. And that was fun. And then I watched another woman make pasta a la limone. Which she's a blonde woman?
That's Molly.
Oh, that's Molly. I might make that dish. It looked very nice. But what struck me was it's shot in New York, and they are really nice people, enjoying their work. And in a way, what struck me was it was an opportunity to see good Americans. After all these Trumpian things.
I've never thought of that while watching Bon Appetit.
These are the kind of Americans that we like. The ones who are chatty, voluble, intelligent, well-educated, college types. Mm-hmm. And these are the ones who are worldly. You could imagine them coming here and not being all... They'd be kind of Anthony Bourdain-ish here. You know, they'd be able to fit in. They're not the ones who would be a challenge.
Yeah, and I think they don't hide that they have... that they have privileged, not all of them, but most of them, privileged backgrounds. You know, one of them has a beautiful house in Cape Cod, and I've got a beautiful backyard with a wood-burning fireplace. I don't think they hide that. And I think that authenticity of not needing to, you know, protect a certain part of their life that they're comfortable with, saying, this is who I am, and these are the mistakes that I've made, but I've learned, and I know my position in society. Yeah. I know that I went to Harvard and I learned all this. I went to culinary school. Yeah.
The other part about the good American thing is also that you're sitting down to a meal, aren't you? I mean, so there is something about the fact that they're cooking and they're showing you how to cook and they are inviting people to take bites of their food. That's a very inclusive thing because that's something that happens throughout the kitchen. It's like, hey, try this. Did you have this? This is great. And so I think to the good American point, I think at a time where perhaps people feel excluded by America, it's a very inclusive show. It's very like, come sit and eat at my table. I've cooked you food. Also worth saying that you've got the very intellectual people who kind of intellectualize what they do and are very cerebral about it. Mentos lady, Claire Saffitz, for instance. And on the flip side of that, you have Brad, you know, somebody who is who openly says, I did not do well in school. I do not speak the English very well. However, I will make a knife. I will do things with my hands. And so there's something for everyone. And I just could not. It has made me so happy.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's Ross. And then there's Chandler.
You mock.
No, I'm not mocking.
I can see it in your eyes that you're going to go home and watch more videos.
I.
Do you know the thing is, we know who Cam is in the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen.
Oh, because, really?
Yeah, yes. You know yes, who he is. Because there's essentially one of every type of trope character, even though, of course, there are more people in the entire office in the test kitchen, but they only showed these 10 or 12 on the show. So you can tell everyone's a different sort of person.
Do we tell him who he is or do we let him discover that on his own?
I think he should go into this completely blind.
Agreed.
And he can come back challenge. Next week and tell us.
It's okay. Very clear. There is a very clear okay. person. Yeah.
All right. Fair enough. But I did enjoy it. And I was looking at trying to gauge a sense of how much revenue they might make. I only had a few minutes to go at this. So I looked at the one which came out just 2 days ago, already 1.5 million hits. And if they're producing a show a day, enough for you to be able to watch a show, maybe even two shows a day, and then you're rewatching. Mm-hmm. If you get like 20,000 hits, you can make 17,000. I mean, per day, 20,000 per day, 17,000 US. I mean, Gangnam Style, which is 1 billion viewers, that made 7.6 million. So
that and the merchandise.
Yeah.
And yes, exactly. And this show, we're not even talking about the merchandising, which is there. So you people are hooked.
I think they've actually said on the show themselves that the readers of their magazine are actually older. They're traditional magazine readers who actually want the recipes. The younger ones, the ones who actually watch the show and the YouTube channel, are all 20 onwards, 20 to 30.
Yeah, because who buys magazines these days?
That's true. Exactly.
Yeah. So we producer Ali, we should do a Bon Bit of Culture somehow, and yeah. I don't know what that means, but we can do it. Monetize. Okay. So, but in a moment, though, we do topic number three, which will be generational catch-up here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Lee Chui Lin, and Julian Liap. And now, Julian, generational catch-up, poor thing.
It is. It feels like it's a plague on all young people today, but not totally. But so recently, Billie Eilish, for anyone who doesn't know, she's a 17-year-old pop R&B.
I think you can, yeah. Pop, yeah, maybe. That's about right.
Yeah. The youngest ever person to be nominated for the big four Grammy Awards this year. So best artist, best album, all of that. And she recently went on the chat show Jimmy Kimmel. And as part of the show, she talks about turning 18, all of this stuff about growing old. And but one part that the media just latched onto was that Jimmy Kimmel decided to quiz her. So complete this sentence, run DM, and she couldn't do that. And name of Van Halen, and she couldn't do that. And she kind of just sits there quiet, and she can't, she looks at the ground because she can't do anything about it because she's put on in this situation where she's on stage with a host that isn't interviewing her. And it's something that I'm sure everyone has had to go through, being felt that you have to be ashamed of knowledge that you don't have, especially as a young person in an industry where you have to know certain things. I think every genre and every subgenre has, you know, pillars of each that you have to know. So if it's hip hop, you know, you have to know Run DMC. I have never heard a gun to my head. I could not name a Run DMC song right now. And it's the same with film. Every bit of film, every genre, you've got well, if it's sci-fi, you have to have watched 2001. You have to have watched all the Star Wars. You know, you have. There's a lot of catch-up that a lot of people have to do, and I don't know.
But you've been putting in the hours. You have. I know you have.
I don't, but I don't like that I have to. I have to feel that I have to, because I'm not going to care if I've never seen a film from 2001 in February or March that made hardly any money at the box office. But it'll bug me if someone asks, you mean you haven't seen this, you know, this big film? Because the expectation that you have to have seen it because it's a pop culture necessary. It's a
relic.
Yeah.
I think we can call it a relic.
Not a relic.
No, because I'm thinking aloud.
Siding with the young people, Lynn. Cool.
Okay, look. Like, there are two millennials here, right, air right now. I am technically a millennial. I'm a middle-aged millennial. I'm not at the upper end, but I'm a middle-aged millennial. Are you even a millennial or are you a Gen Zer?
I'm just at the brink.
Right. So I think that for me, I know who Run DMC is. I can name literally one Van Halen. And I don't know. That's about it. But like, Eddie. But
yeah, is there another?
I don't know. That's what I'm saying.
Producer Ali? So, oh, there's only one. Yeah.
So that's the thing, right? But I think that the real question here, aside from the feeling of having to play catch up, which is a bit formal, let's be real. I think the other part of it is, who is deciding that this is the knowledge that I need to have in order to function? You know, like why do you get to tell me that I need to participate in something that was big for you when you were 18? Big freaking whoop. Are you participating with what's big for me when I was 18?
She's pointing at me.
I am. And that is purely
a
numbers.
Angry look on her face.
It's a numbers game, Cam. That's all it is. I get it. I completely understand. Who is deciding that I need to have this knowledge?
But Lynn, did you ever have these conversations, people saying, oh, you can't possibly know until you've seen such and such? Because I never had that.
I never had that either. But I did feel a sort of, on my own, like, oh, do I need to know what a rosebud is? Do I need to know what, like all these other big references that people will throw around. And if you don't get it, it's like, what do you mean? You know, so I did feel the need to sort of do that on my own. So
it's,
I think,
homework, right?
It feels that way in order to participate sometimes on a cultural level. But also, some of it was fun. I mean, like, and I did it because I wanted to. I wanted to see what Fred Astaire looked like dancing. I don't know if that counts as homework. But, you know, you want to see these things. Mm. And I wanted to see what was so great. And oftentimes, they were great. But I feel a lot of, I feel this particularly from people who engage in the 80s. Because that is a decade of content I have absolutely no interest in.
Poor thing.
I don't care for it.
And they are always, you know, sort of held in this, on this pedestal of, wow, back in the 80s, there was this one film that was great. And a lot of the time, a lot of this content, because the ones who are consuming it then are the ones who are in the industry now, who are reviewing it, selling it. So a lot of the time, all of that content is skewed male and white male, straight male. And it's hard as anyone out of that, other than that, to see anything that I can enjoy in that. I do enjoy it because fundamentally it is good, like you said, Lynn, but it's almost, I don't want to consume, you know, Aliens isn't easy to consume for me. I love Aliens, but it's hard because it's so pro, you know, pro-military, pro-guns.
Pro-guns,
yeah.
Aliens is rubbish. The first one, Alien, is great, though. I remember reading somewhere on Twitter, I think, somebody posted a thing saying, to help my fellow college graduates out, there are certain things you need to know in order to understand your lecturers. Make sure you go out and watch Ferris Bueller's Day Off and you watch the first two seasons of The Simpsons, because your college professors will use those as references in order to try and make a connection with you young people. And I can understand that, because actually, like, I do actually use just those very things.
I watched Ferris Bueller very late. I watched Ferris Bueller because I grew tired of not understanding the Bueller and, you know, just references. And I was like, all right, fine. And I watched it and it was delightful. Really enjoyed it. I still do not use it as a cultural touch point in my own life.
No, of course.
You know, and more so than that, I think I pick on the 80s because it is an aesthetic I don't enjoy. Mm. So I like some things about it, but I have to really cherry pick. And so whenever I'm being told, like, you're mean, I'm like, no, it's fine. It's okay. I'm going to sidestep.
Yeah. I was there during the 80s. And so I had to make no effort to understand the 80s. It was just happening to me. It was just like, you know, and my memory is still such that I can still remember those things. I think that perhaps, though, Julian, can one say that, that if people are saying this to you, and I think they're saying it to you more than many others, it perhaps is a compliment to you because you actually do wish to know things, and you especially have a real wish to know about popular culture.
Yeah.
And so people who are perhaps patronizing and who were there and who feel that they have a body of knowledge would like to help Julian Yup go in the right direction,
well,
and you must know
that,
those things.
To that, I think that there's also a different way of phrasing, you know, choosing the language that you use, because instead of, you know, asking, what, you haven't seen that? How have you not seen that? You have, you must watch it. I think it's, you know, just a few, you know, changing your words a little bit, just saying, you know, oh, it's great because, and explain why you like it so much. Tell me why you love it so that I can experience it for myself. And then we can have a conversation about it. Do you want to watch it with me? We can go and watch it.
It's so I should not.
It's an invitation rather than a looking down, an opportunity to show your superiority and also to shame someone else.
And can I still wag my finger in your face though?
That's fine.
Yeah.
You're special, Ken. You can do whatever.
But no one ever said this to you, Lynn?
Not no one. I think it's a little bit different also because Julian's engagement with film is a lot deeper than mine.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So I'm sort of a casual, I'm a film fan, but I don't necessarily kind of deep dive into it that often. So because of that, I don't meet that sort of hard edge of nerdery where people go, you mean you haven't? If I haven't, it's not shocking.
Or I think even with content from the 90s, TV shows, sitcoms became big in the 90s, right? So any small references, there have been a few. I think I've said before, I don't know anything about Frasier.
Or Cheers,
or
that was
Cheers,
the other one, yeah.
Seinfeld.
Do you mean you've not said, sorry, I gotta stop. Stop it.
It's an epidemic.
But also, I mean, the amount of content that's, it just every year more and more accumulates. I mean, I'm that much older than you, so I only needed to know that much stuff. I mean, popular music began with Elvis. Anything before that, we don't really need to know, you know. I mean, it's like 40 years on top of what I just knew. And generations hence will have to know more and more because popular music will always have begun at Elvis.
Yeah. And I do know that it's not something that is completely new to anyone who's born 95 and after. But, you know, 60s, everyone had to figure out, you know, film from before. 40s, 50s, it's always moving, but it's not. I think there's a different way that conversation can be had. And I think we can remove that feeling of, you know, that feeling of that you have to, that these are the prerequisites of being a human and engaging in pop culture.
Okay. All right. Well, you told me. No, Lynn, you're scot-free. You're like, you know, you're on, yeah, okay, fine.
Middle-aged millennial.
Yeah,
that's my business card.
Yeah, you straight got in there, didn't you? Okay. So, but you have obviously watched Lawrence of Arabia.
I have not.
Oh, well.
I know there's some sort of famous...
It's boring.
Oh, okay, you just went for it.
Actually, no, but the thing is, I very quickly though, I mean, I grew up with, you know, Lawrence of Arabia is one of those great... It's a great film, it really is.
Yeah.
And it was sold to me as being a great... And I loved it. It's my favorite movie. But now when I think in this world now, it's entirely male characters. There are no females in it whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in the director's cut, they put back a couple of scenes which had women just in the background. And I think that was a conscious effort on their part to talk about this is what men, the world that men kind of create. But it had Alec Guinness, an Englishman playing an Arab, could not be done now. And so in many ways, some of the things which I grew up with, the Mount Rushmores, the icons of my age, are becoming a little bit embarrassing. And so they no longer hold as being, you must watch such and such.
Mm.
I'd have to sort of tell you quietly, you know, by the way, there's this thing called Lawrence of Arabia. You might want to check it out. It didn't come from me. So anyway. Okay. Well, I will be more understanding in future.
This wasn't a personal attack.
I don't
on
know.
Cam, by
I
the
don't
way.
Know. I don't know. Yeah,
I might have wagged my finger. That's on me.
She did. Okay. So we move on to the last part of the show. Recommendations, where I recommend something that I think might be of interest. I go first. And I was recently at the Georgetown Literary Festival and I interviewed a guy there who's a really fascinating fellow. And I've been reading his book. It's fiction, Lynn.
Look at you.
I know. It's like a made up story and everything. And it's really good. It's really good. And his name is Hamid Ismailov, and he's from Uzbekistan. And the book that I read is called The Devil's Dance. And it's it reminds me of the other Russian novels that I've read. I have read Russian novels, by the way.
Lynn. How long ago?
Does it matter? They're still in the memory bank. How do I describe it? It's about a true life Uzbek writer called Khodori, who was dragged away by the NKVD, the precursors of the KGB, in 1937, and he was executed. But before he went into the prison, he told everybody he was going to write a particular novel about a particular character, this slave girl who went on to be married to three of the Uzbek Khans. And so he's now written this novel that was never written, and it's really good. So that's simply my recommendation, the novel by Hamid Ismailov called The Devil's Dance.
I'm going to cheat a little bit because it's been a while since I've been on the show. I've been building up recommendations. So I'm just going to piggyback on Georgetown Literary Festival because Cam went, I did not, but I've been doing some interviews related to it. One of which is with Long Lit Woon or Lit Woon Long. She wrote a book called The Way Through the Woods on Mushrooms and Mourning. And she's actually a Malaysian woman who married a Norwegian man and lived there. And after his death, kind of started getting into mushrooming, you know, like actually foraging for mushrooms. And the way she writes about it is so beautiful and, you know, reveals this whole world that we don't see. Like, we don't see mushrooms. And she said once you know how, suddenly the whole world is full of possibilities and connections. And it ties, I guess, her process of mourning her husband to her process of learning about mushrooms. And so it's a very hopeful, beautiful book. I haven't finished it, but I'm just kind of speeding through it because it's so great. And Cam, it is nonfiction, so yeah, we are learning from one another.
I met her, and the book has been very successful.
It's great. Yeah. I really enjoyed it.
Very successful in Europe and especially in America.
Mm.
Very popular.
And my other thing is related to, ironically enough, the 90s, and that is a podcast called Slow Burn by Slate, specifically season 3, which focuses on the beef between Tupac Shakur and the Notorious B.I.G., which is a fantastic deep dive into kind of East Coast, West Coast hip-hop drama back in the 90s, how it started, you know, a turf war, how it started, all these various things that eventually led to violence. And it is fantastic. If you have any interest in hip-hop, if you have any interest in Tupac or Biggie, it is great. So yeah, season 3 of Slow Burn.
That's what I should be listening to learn.
But you see, I just spoke about why I loved it.
Yeah.
I didn't push it.
You really mix it up, Lynn, don't you? It's like mushrooming 1 second and suddenly it's like the East Coast, West Coast.
And those are the two things that I'm consuming at the moment and seriously enjoying. So yeah.
Okay. All right. Julian.
So I was not at the Georgetown Literary Festival, and I do not read, so I'm sorry.
Well, you should, young lady.
And with these recommendations, I will. I would like to recommend a film, one of my favorite films from the year, I think, and that is Her Smell by Alex Ross Perry, and it stars Elizabeth Moss, and it's kind of related to this, to the topic. Being a pop star or an indie rocker, I don't really know what she is, the type of music. The music in this is great also, by the way. They have original music about a singer who, after she has done the whole sex, drugs, rock and roll, all of that, she's ruined the relationships in her life and the relationship with her kid and her ex-husband and her everyone around her, and how she goes through the journey of trying to find forgiveness within herself and with other people and coming back for a reunion, for a performance, because ultimately she is a performer. And it's that idea of what constitutes greatness when it comes to a career in the spotlight. How do you return to that? And I love it. It was such an experience to watch because it's very cinema verite. You know, it follows you around as she goes from room to room, and you can see a character being very destructive to herself and to people around her, but you cannot pull away. The music, of, like I said, is great.
Elizabeth Moss plays a rock and roll singer.
Yes.
I can't see that.
Elizabeth Moss can be anything she
great,
wants. She can be a mushroom that is plucked from the ground. I'd watch it. She's just great.
Wow, okay. Mm. And it's called again?
Her Smell.
And available at all your local favorite...
Amazon or Hulu, one of them.
Right, right. Yes. Okay. So we just have to, you know, suggest that they can be done legally. That's all. Yes. Yes, and it can. So, well, great. Okay. And, well, that brings us to the end of this week's show, where it's been a wonderful return of Lee Chui Lin.
Thank you for not taking your personal attack personally.
Who says I didn't? Julian, yeah.
And thank you for not for taking your personal attack not so personally.
Oh, I didn't even know there was one from you. So there was. Damn it. And I promised to not wag my finger at you and say, you haven't seen Billy Wilder's Ace in the Hold? What kind of movie expert are you?
Is that
you
about
see?
Golf?
No, you see? You see? Young people got so much to learn. And anyway, myself, Cam Rustland, and that brings us to the end of this week's show. And please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.